Welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Jarmusch, and we're now in the final episode of our series with Dr. Birgit Schule. Again, I recommend listening to parts 1 and 2 before this one for the context. In this segment, we consider the adaptation of artificial intelligence to this research and the many benefits of organ-on-a-chip systems towards more rapidly advancing our understanding. Once again, welcome back, Birgit. This is going to be the last of our segments in this series. We may speak again in the future.
Yeah.
And so this time around, I would like to ask you about your thoughts on the furthering of our understanding of Parkinson's disease, whether it's the development of the disorder over time or treatment, therapeutics, anything else that you are particularly looking forward to in the future.
Yeah, thinking about Parkinson's disease and neurodegeneration, I think we have several pillars that are advancing in parallel towards hopefully new innovative therapies for Parkinson's disease. And the one area is the clinic and the patient. So mm-hmm. we are now more sophisticated with our ways to diagnose Parkinson's disease through new imaging technologies, through a new biomarker assay, through more better clinical care. So that's one area. The research has expanded so much from a number of proteins like alpha-synuclein or LRRK2 to many more genes and proteins, different aspects of cell biology. A big thing is immunology, neuroimmunology for neurodegeneration. And then that all leads into therapies. And so we talked about omics, single cell omics, machine learning, new animal models. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all say there's no good model. All models are wrong. Some are useful. So I think for animal models, there is a new way to analyze behavior of animals. So we're using open field moving around of animals without pushing them into certain tests, pole tests, water mazes, things like that, that are really stressful for the animals. We just have them walk around in on a platform.
And then ambiently display symptoms.
Right. And we do this in the dark because they're much more comfortable in the dark. And then we videotape them from below so that we can see their paws.
Interesting.
And so then we use machine learning tools to actually analyze those patterns. And that's a more natural behavior. And so that allows us also to tease out quite some interesting differences, even between male and female mice, mm-hmm. because in research now, there is a tendency that we say, well, you have to look at both sexes. Yeah, so you have to have female mice and male mice, or I mean, also in the clinic and so on, of course. But usually people say, oh, there's no difference. But now we can really kind of tease out subtle differences that are also different in disease mice versus control mice. So that's a new area. Yeah, on the other hand, you want to reduce the amount of animals that are used in research. So I think that's also a really new frontier in science, to use stem cell modeling, making 3D organoid organ models, and then put them on microfluidic chips so that you have like a liver and a kidney and then a blood system with immune cells and muscle, brain on one chip.
So that you can all self-contained and viable.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And that's also really cool. That's a real new area. And that really was only able to develop through IPS reprogramming discovery, through omics technologies, through better bioengineering. So that's really something that will really take off in the next decade. And hopefully we can reduce also animal models. And since this is, since these models are all based on human stem cells, hopefully these models are actually better than animal models and are more predictive for clinical trials.
Right, especially because, you know, obviously we can't just take a sizable portion of the population and induce a disease state that's for a million unnecessarily described reasons,
right,
horribly and unethical.
And you can make your own little personalized organ
or testing environment.
test environment. So the idea is, for example, to use that for pharmacogenetics genomics. So you can use your own chip, and then you add different, let's say, cancer drugs on it, and then see which ones respond best. So I mean, personally, I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I went through 2 years of testing different drugs to kind of ease my pain. And so if I would have my own organisms on a chip, I'd much rather have them tested than me taking those drugs. So that would be fantastic.
Talk about personalized medicine there, especially because you know, even if you had your own, say, liver cells on a chip in isolation, your liver is not in isolation in your body.
Right.
And if you had somebody else's, virtual, I don't know what the phrasing is for, but like this micro environment of their cells, you've got their liver and their brain and their lungs and kidneys and what have you. They've lived a different life. Their body is not your body. Now, you can talk male, female, you can talk just somebody else and yourself, older, younger, any other combination you'd like to say, but none of that will be the model that is as useful as your own model.
Exactly.
All models will still be wrong, but you can have a more useful model. And it does sound a lot like we're getting closer to that.
Yeah.
Quickly,
and I've been to a conference this summer on organs on a chip in Berlin. And I feel like in Europe, there's a really big push, number one, to reduce animal models, but then really kind of elevate these organs on chip. So there's a really cool institute in Berlin. It's called the Simulated Human. I mean,
I love the name.
So that's hopefully that's something that really will give us more answers and be able to also test drugs so that you don't have to test on people, because it's horrible to take something and have side effects, but it's not really making you better or treating your symptoms or your disease. So
right. Plus, it would theoretically advance drug discovery or therapeutic discovery rates, because you don't need to go through the trial and error with animal models and see if you can even get this drug into a cell, much less if it does its job after that.
Exactly. And now also in vitro, there are blood-brain barrier models where you can test
drugs,
because that's a big problem in the field. Yeah, so the blood-brain barrier that sometimes prohibits drugs to go through and really reach the brain. So those are also models that are available and seem to be quite useful.
So do you see you already are using CRISPR in your work? Are you expecting that to have an increasingly powerful effect as time goes on?
Yeah, well, it is already super, super powerful. If you think about it, it was discovered 10 years ago. I mean, maybe, plus minus
give or take,
about a decade ago. And I mean, basically every other lab is using some form of CRISPR, either editing cell lines, doing CRISPR screens, trying to use CRISPR in some kind of therapeutic approach, editing cells, and then putting them back into an organism, or putting CRISPR into an organism. I mean, all kinds of ways. And also CRISPR, you can use it for so many different technologies, applications in the lab. So you can fuse the CRISPR protein with reporters, or I mean, you can mm-hmm. guide it in places you never go before. Or it's just fantastic what you can do with CRISPR. You can edit, you can activate, inactivate, you can add fluorescent reporters, and it just kind of it just a huge toolbox.
It sounds almost like sounds like a whole new world of research applications that, yeah. I mean, I don't know a better way to say it than is completely in its infancy, right? This has been, like you said, give or take 10 years, and we've seen so much of an impact already.
It just
exploded. What could the next, what can 5-10 more look or bring to us?
And it's also democratized. I mean, before there were gene editing tools, there were talons, there were zinc mm-hmm. fingers, but those were very, very expensive. And you couldn't design it yourself. There were patents on it, and it was very difficult to use them. They were also not as efficient. But now it's very easy. You just have to design your oligos, and you buy your CRISPR plasmids, and you're on the way. Before, it was almost not impossible, but it was much more cumbersome to do gene editing.
Right, but at this stage, identifying a short oligonucleotide sequence that you need as a targeting vector, that's easy. I think we had spoken about it one of the recent episodes where, once upon a time, that was basically a PhD. Right? Finding the ideal sequence to do a thing and the process that it took to get there, but... there are thousands of people a day doing that now.
That's right. No, it has shifted quite a bit.
Do you anticipate that the work that you've done with Parkinson's can be adapted to other neurodegenerative disorders, or maybe just other genetic disorders?
Yeah, good question. In theory, people are always trying to find technologies that are more platform technologies that can mm-hmm. be applied for different diseases. For CRISPR, definitely. I mean, and right. any gene you want to manipulate, sure. And we have this gene therapy where we have a virus, and then we build in the CRISPR Cas and then the guide RNAs, and it really depends how you design your guide RNA. You can target any gene, so that could be applied to anything. So that's one part. In terms of other neurodegenerative diseases and other proteins there, if we think about neurodegenerative diseases, we think about Parkinson's, we think about Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. we think about some more rarer diseases that have features of both of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So they are called, for example, multisystem atrophy, PSP, frontotemporal dementia, things like that. And overall, there are four different proteins that are involved. So we talked about a lot about alpha-synuclein. Another protein is tau. Then there mm-hmm. is beta amyloid and a protein that's called TDP-43. So, I mean, in theory, these are all proteins that aggregate in the brain of patients with neurodegenerative diseases. And what's also interesting is in a recent neuropathology paper found that in patients that are demented, that have dementia, in about 20% of them, you find all four pathologies together in one brain.
Wow.
So I think that is something that we only start to understand. I think neuropathologists knew all along that you have these co-pathologies, but they wouldn't tell the average researcher or the public, because they would only then focus on the most severe pathology. Yeah, so if there is alpha synuclein pathology in Lewy bodies, they call it Parkinson's disease. But oftentimes you have also tau, amyloid, TDP-43, but to a lesser extent. So then that would not be mentioned, or it would be mentioned, but they were just some scores and kind of not explain what that means.
So we might start to discover more about the interplay between these four and perhaps others.
Right. And let's say if you have these co-pathologies that are severe, if you have a therapeutic target against alpha-synuclein, but there's still this tau or amyloid pathology happening or concurrently ongoing in the brain, do you actually cure that disease, or do you actually do something, or do you have to target both of these proteins?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe not.
So we are running out of time. I did want to extend, obviously, first, a major thank you. This has been very informative to me personally, hopefully to everyone listening. It has also been a sincere pleasure to have this opportunity to talk to you. But before we go, is there anything you want to put out there, anything you want to highlight, whether it's something your team is doing, anyone on your team, or anything just that is coming to mind that we didn't have a chance to discuss?
Oh, wow.
And now you're on the spot. I told you I wasn't going to do it, but now you're on the spot.
Yeah, I know. You caught me there. So I mean, I really think this work that we're doing here is only possible because there's so many people that work together that want to solve these unsolvable conditions, and that's great. So we have to keep sticking to it, keep moving to make a difference.
This is the end of our series with Dr. Birger Schuller. Machine learning techniques are advancing image analysis. Organs on a chip are increasing the likelihood of individualized research and treatments taking hold. CRISPR is improving the capacity to identify new treatment modes. Alpha-synuclein may yet be at the center of Parkinson's. And the exploration of the disease's causes, symptoms, and therapies are gaining traction at an ever-accelerating rate. Not least of all, Dr. Schuller is undaunted by the duty the community has.